Hi, I am Jenny Lynn Christofferson. I am the Marketing and Communications Associate here at Timeline. And I am joined by the wonderful Miriam Robinson, who is our resident dramaturg. And she also dramaturged this fantastic show that we are currently streaming, To Master the Art by William Brown and Doug Brew. Hi, Miriam, how are you?
Hi, I'm well. How are you?
I'm so good. I'm so happy you're here with me.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me and meeting me electronically. And to everybody who's out there listening electronically, thank you for joining us this way, too.
So I wanted to talk about this fantastic show. So there's just so much, it's filled with so much joy and so much heart. And this is almost a completely real story, right? They didn't really fictionalize a lot of it, correct?
Yeah, it really is the work of a lot of research and love and background. Yeah, just background research that they did, both using a number of books. There was My Life in France, which was written by Julia Child's nephew. That was the source. And the big biography, Julia Child, by Noel Fitch had come out. But they actually went to the Schlesinger Library and had access and got access to her papers and letters and correspondence. So they actually spent days just kind of leafing through letters that they wrote back and forth from their time in France. And since it was such a different time period, that was the mode of communication. So there are a lot more details about their life. The letters are very newsy, very conversational. And a lot of that information is what comes right back into the structure of the play and the stories and conversations that are happening as we go through. So, yeah.
That's awesome. Pretty much the brunt of this play really is following Julia and Paul in France, and then Julia discovering cooking and kind of going to writing this massive French cookbook. So talk to me a little bit about why, like, the historical significance of that thing that she did at that time. I think Doug and Bill have both been quoted saying it was a thing no one needed. Everybody keeps saying it's the thing that no one needed, but she thought differently.
Yeah, I think there's something really interesting about Julia that comes out throughout the play, both in the time period of the play and when we see her. And I think it really is, like, this is sort of the Julia Child origin story of her as Julia Child, chef, you know, author, all of these things. And we kind of get to see her become what we would know. But I think even before we see her on stage, she led this life that was just a little bit outside the box. She was a different thinker. So, you know, she was raised with a lot of privilege and wealth and went to the girls' schools and did all of the things she was supposed to do. And she wasn't married when she graduated from college, like all the other girls were in that era. And so she didn't want to do other boring things. And she ended up in the OSS, which was the precursor to the CIA, which is how she met Paul. But so you think of her as somebody who's like, oh no, here's this woman who's raised in one way, but she keeps choosing to do something that is not what's expected. And I think that follows her to her time in France, where she's like, no, I like this. Why don't I study it more? When, you know, she came from a household that they wouldn't have cooked. They would have had a cook, right? So there, she's kind of breaking these barriers, and her love of French cuisine and her firm belief that other people would love it if they just had access to it and they didn't have to struggle as hard at the Cordon Bleu with various people who were not as supportive of her progress there, shall we say, that they would love it. And she just had that confidence in it. And I think that passion took her through until there were just other people like Judith Jones who saw the book and could see, like, yes, this is a masterwork. This is a piece of art. And there are people who are going to love it. They don't know they need it, but they will need it. They don't know they want it. Nobody thinks they want it, but this is the thing they will want. Is really kind of a testament both to her vision and her tenacity. Like, it's a very quiet tenacity to just sort of subtly resist the pressures of family and class and social norms to just sort of do the things that she wants to do and become, you know, and that's true by the time she's a television personality. She's not the right age. She's not the right appearance. None of these things are the things that she should be to become, you know, a TV star. And she does. And I think that's part of what we love about her is that she is none of those things. And she feels somehow very real to us, very genuine, always.
She is so undeniably Julia Child. Like, she is just inexplicably herself, right? She's just this force and this energy. And I think what I want to ask you about is, you know, this, she came to this late in her life, right? This
whole
resurgence.
She was, you know, I think, what is it, 39 before she had even cooked, and, you know, she's like 50 when she's on television, right? These are not, this is not your normal story. This is a midlife passion. And I think there's something exciting about that, too. A lot of the narratives we're given are love stories about young people. They are young people finding themselves, right? There's the coming of age story. Well, this is Julia's coming of age story, but she came of age in middle age, right? And there's something I think that's sort of consoling about that as more and more people have to reinvent themselves as they change, you know, they change jobs, they move cities, they get divorced or remarried, they have to reinvent themselves. And there's something beautiful about a story that is about two adult people who are in love, about somebody who's in love with a new passion and is figuring out a way to make a career out of that. That I think is refreshing to see on stage.
And there's nothing that's put on about her either, right? Like, everything about her is just extremely authentic.
There's not this effort to, you know, I think there was a little bit sometime early in her life, people critiqued her voice. And I think when she was in her youth, they made her take these like vocal lessons or something, but she clearly had just what was her own voice by the time she was done with it, right? She didn't end up sounding like anybody else. Whatever she did not make her sound like a debutante, right? And I think she was fine with that. She came to some sort of comfort with herself. And, you know, there were some great quotes from her later in her career where she was talking about sort of American kind of eating fads, the fads around eating and in terms of health, and the way that that made eating into this chore or this enemy, as opposed to like, this is something that sustains you. You should love it. It should feel good. You shouldn't feel guilty. You shouldn't feel like there should be pleasure in doing this thing. There's something about that I think is also true sort of about her, and that authentic part is like, no, that's just, things should be real. They should be genuine. The food should be fresh. You shouldn't feel guilty about adding a little cream. You shouldn't be guilty, right? There's a sense in which she is very un-American and not sort of buying into fads and buying into guilt and buying into sort of, you know, she's clearly her own body, right? And happy in that body. I love some of the photographs of her in France that Paul took of her because he was an avid photographer. And there's one where she's like sitting in a skirt kind of on the beach and it's a sunny day. She has sort of a bikini on and this kind of, it's either shorts or a skirt and her legs extended and she's smoking a cigarette. And there's actually something about her that looks kind of sexy because she is just comfortable in herself. And there's something about that photo that just makes me think that is how Paul saw her, right? This tall woman who was taller than he was, who like was kind of outsized in all ways, was beautiful to him because of that sort of passion and comfort in her own skin.
You know, you experience it through this play, but I kind of feel like Julie and Paul Child were the perfect timeline couple. They valued, you know, they valued history, they valued archiving things, they valued holding on to stuff and finding ways to learn from our past and to move forward. You kind of touched on, Paul was an avid photographer, so talk to me a little bit more about that and how that, you know, that influenced their lives as well.
Yeah, it's so interesting because I think, you know, it's part of why there's beautiful documentation of that too, and his photographs are also in the Schlesinger now, and a lot of them are online. If you go to the library there, you can actually look at a lot of the photographs, which actually before the second production, since I'd been dramaturg on the initial production and it was being remounted and I was dramaturg again, I was trying to think of some new gift to give the cast. And I actually made for them a Paul and Julia Child photo album, which I walked into the first rehearsal and I presented it to Doug and Bill, and Bill opened it and looked at it and gasped, and then he hugged it to his chest. And I was just this, it was such a lovely moment that I could like kind of create this artistic thing for them that was trying to encapsulate the world of their play in a slightly different way. And so that lived in the rehearsal room and passed around with the cast so that they could kind of enjoy these photos of their life. And so there's even that quality of like, he documented their life in France, he documented their life in Norway because they actually continued moving on with the in government service for a little while. And then later on he ends up photographing food for her books. I mean, he's very hands-on and becomes sort of an impresario for her career, and was there on set and sketched out designs for the set and where she was going to be and where the lights were, and drew illustrations of cuts of meat for books. And I mean he became heavily involved in her passions and supportive of them, even as he was shifting away from sort of I think a certain amount of bitterness at the tail end of his career in government service. I think that piece of it was hard for him. They'd been in the OSS and then they were part of the Marshall Plan to kind of sell America to Europe to kind of prevent the rise of communism. And so he was there trying to do art shows of American artists and music and keep America front and center in a positive way in France. And the fact that McCarthyism is rising at the same time, the fact that he gets questioned, which is true, it's in the play. And we've had a couple of discussions now, and everybody wants to know if that was real. It was, he was questioned. And that's his description of it in a letter to a friend is sort of where that scene comes from. So he, there was a certain amount of outrage of feeling like a government had turned against them, or the country that they knew was sort of behaving differently than they had expected, given that they were there in France being those diplomats, being Americans who were exploring and loving French food and meeting French people and doing things in this with this openness and willingness to sort of understand other people. There was a frustration that suddenly they weren't even being understood by their own country. And I think that was something that was hard for him, and that shift to sort of channeling his passions into Julia's passions was a natural shift.
They were just such a solid partnership, right? It was just a true partnership.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. We had a comment from somebody in one of the discussions that they had met him and that he was a bit of a martinet and difficult and other things. And that they sort of accused us or accused the playwrights of softening Paul and making him gentler than he was. But I do think that there is something of a very modern, I'm sure they were people of their own time, right? But there is something modern about their relationship too. There are these, and I do think there's just a huge amount of love that is what Bill and Doug were, digging into in the letters that they had. And a lot of, affectionate language between them and in the way they refer to each other in the letters they were sending. And even they had this tradition of sending these Valentines to friends and family that were photographs they took of themselves in different places. And, sometimes with big hearts on themselves, and they would,
oh my God,
decorate them all up and then they would send them off. And there's like a really famous one. It's the two of them, like apparently naked in a bathtub with bubble bath all around them. And it has a little heart around it. It says, "Wish you were here." And they sent these to their friends and family. Like there is something actually whimsical and charming about their love for each other and the way they shared it publicly with their friends and family that I think seems honestly genuine. And I think that's what Doug and Bill were responding to in their research and wanted to embody in the play.
And I think that comes off very clearly too. I think, every time Karen and Craig are on stage, I mean, I'm just beaming from ear to ear. There's just so much energy and so much passion and chemistry there. You know, you can't can't manufacture that kind of stuff. So it's really cool to see that. As we're kind of wrapping up the conversation, I guess I wanted to say, so you were on the 2010 production and then back 2013, and here we are 2020.
I'm back again.
I'm back again. is there anything that you wanted to learn more of now, or you looked back at old research from either of those productions and thought, oh wow, this actually has another sense of resonance to where we are now versus where we were in 2010 or 2013, telling a story from
I think so. You know, I mean, first it was sort of a delight to end up getting to revisit a play multiple times. You don't often get to do that. And as a dramaturg, each time I come back to it, I'm like, oh, what can I bring this time that's a little bit different? You know, and so you do go back to your research and look at it and are like, huh, does this hold up? Is there more I should have done here or there? And in this one, I think the thing that has struck me and struck me in watching it is, well, two things. One is that I think that desire for good food, good company, companionship feels very strong right now, you know, in the midst of a pandemic, because that's now the context we're in. It feels akin to all of these people suddenly breaking out their cookbooks again and trying to bake their own bread and posting their results online. And I think that speaks to a longing for community. It speaks to a longing for the kinds of dinners that Paul and Julia would have with friends and sit down and have a long French style meal with conversation and good food and good drink. And, you know, that's not available to most of us right now. But it is possible to bake your own bread. And so I think that is where that sense of pride in doing something from scratch is something that people are rediscovering right now, and trying to find the value in being forced to do something more slowly, maybe, and which is something that Chef Bunyard talks to her about, like that you should, it's not a race that you have to, like, you should be spending time in it. It should even be a pleasure to clean up, you know? And then the other piece that really hit home to me was, you know, I think people have always asked in post-show discussions, like, a little bit about the McCarthyism and the way that creeps in and why that's in the play when it could just be this frothy love story, and just this lovely, delectable thing about France. But it was real. It was part of their life. You know, as Bill and Doug were always pointing out, they worked for the government. They were political. They had friends in politics. The letters that they wrote back and forth were political. They were talking about the events of the day. They were talking about their government. They were talking about what they were seeing and the sorts of fears in their world, which were very real. And you know, in our moment, we feel our fears. When we look back, we're like, oh, the Red Scare, that was really crazy. What was that about? Well, in that moment, it wasn't. It was real to a lot of people, and it was divisive to a lot of people. And I think that part sort of hit home to me, that sense of trying to balance these two things, right? Trying to balance living your life, being fulfilled, having a good meal, seeing good friends, and then also trying to balance the politics and the realities and the scary things about the world we live in, and figure out how you navigate those things is still entirely true. And that hit home to me a lot in watching it now, and then going back and reflecting on the research was, how important actually I think that political thread of the storyline is to the play.
Right. Living is the good and the bad. You can't just have half of it, or else you're not really living.
Right.
So I love that does come into the play. Well, awesome. Thank you so much for being here and chatting about Julia and Paul and all the amazing things you learned on the show. And folks, you can still catch the show through June 7th on our website at timelinetheaters.com/to-master-the-arts. Thank you again, Marian.
Yeah. If you want to come back and talk to me, there, I think there are still two more discussion opportunities too. Okay. If they want to come back and talk to me and talk to members of the cast, we'll still be around to chat about it. So,
yes, please.